Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Teamcast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Machine Critical Team Institute. The Teamcast is a show where my colleagues, along with our guests, discuss all things mission critical teams. Mission critical teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less, where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission-critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the Teamcast.
Today's conversation is between me, Coleman Ruiz, and Dr. Preston Klein. We discuss a concept we call residue, the substance that experience and memories leave behind. This idea that over time we build up a collection of these experiences that in large part make up who we are. We discuss what it is like to go to war and what it is like when you choose the hard path.
A few years ago when, as we mentioned in one of our previous podcasts, we became really interested in this question of the tacit knowledge transfer problem. And it was really around this idea of how do we get instructor cadre to move past the you suck, suck less conversation. And so in partnership with several of the special operations teams around the world and the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, we decided to create a framework on the learning cycle within an evolution. So think hostage rescue, think trauma resuscitation, think something like that. So a brief intact event where a number of people have to work together. And so the question is, if you're teaching someone how to do that, what language do you use to improve their performance? And we wanted to benchmark this against the research in neuroscience because we felt that was a science that was pretty solid, obviously. So where it came down to was a paper that we released and we'll talk about in a future podcast, Teamcast, called the DR4 model. And that stands for Detection, Recognition, Reaction, Response, and now Reset. When we originally did the model, it was detection, recognition, reaction, response, and recovery. And at the time, the human performance research was on the recovery of an athlete. And that's how we were thinking about it. As you will see, that is important and still true, but it doesn't actually describe a number of variables that happen with operators. As we were doing this research, Coleman and I know many people around the world in all these different industries, and I've been doing the research now for 10, 12 years. And many of the people that I started the research with were now retiring or getting out or transitioning to other things. And the network of people that we knew had grown to hundreds, maybe thousands, right? And as a result, as being part of this network, what you get from time to time is a notification that one of your friends has died. And in this field, the work that we live in and do work in and partner with, the propensity for death is quite high, either because of combat or because of injury or because of whatever. But one of the things that started to emerge was the fatality rate due to suicide. We started to get more people that were dying because they were taking their own lives. This is not just true in special operations, it's true in fire and medicine, especially now. And so this is the background, the context, right? And so a year and a half ago in 2018, a friend of mine who was a contributor to the residue paper invited me down to a Wounded Warriors event for one of the special mission units. And it was a tricky thing to do because they wanted to raise funds for folks who had to live in the shadows. They couldn't really come out and say, hey, I've been to so-and-so place and I've been hurt. That doesn't really work for them. So they need support in sort of more discreet ways. And so he asked me to come down and be a VIP. And I say that with small V, small I, small P, VIP at a Wounded Warriors event. And I said, sure. And so I went down there to Alexandria to this event, and lovely event. There were some admirals there, some generals there, and also the actor Tom Hardy. What I did not know is that Tom Hardy had gotten access to my research through some friends of ours, mutual friends of ours, who named in the paper, and I'll let you do that. I'm not going to do names because it's too confusing about who I can and can't name, so I'm just ignoring the whole thing. It's in the paper. You can read it if you'd like, and we encourage you to. So I was down there, and I didn't actually know that Tom had been getting access to my research, and I didn't know that he's a really nice guy. It's sort of what you want when you meet an actor of his caliber. You want him to be a nice guy because you don't want to suddenly find out that this person's a jerk. But it turns out Tom's an incredibly nice guy, And like a number of folks in his field have spent a lot of their time and energy supporting veterans, supporting wounded warriors, et cetera. And so he had agreed to come down and basically use his movie Spawn, at the time it was just coming out, use his movie premiere as a way to raise funds for this event. And so Tom was there, I was there, some people were there, and sure enough, the night goes along, and Tom arrives with his entourage, and I'm like, oh, look, the actor Tom Hardy, and I'm not really thinking about it. But all of a sudden, he sees me, and he comes walking over, and I'm like, oh, gosh, I got to get out of the way. I'm probably standing in his VIP section, but he's coming to talk to me, and which was a surprise, honestly. And so he meets me, he shakes my hand, and he starts asking me all of these questions about liminality, about the depths of my research, and I'm like, oh, it's a practical joke. The boys have put Tom up to like mess with me, the academic, got it. Okay, I'll play along. Except that Tom is getting very into his questions. Like there's some depth and sophistication to his questions. So then I'm like, man, that's some commitment to a practical joke. Like you actually had to read a lot to. And then finally, about 20 minutes in, I have to stop. I was just so confused. Talk about dissonance. And I'm like, Tom, look, I love these questions. I will talk to you all night. But I'm so confused as to where are you coming from? How do you know this stuff? He's like, well, I read your dissertation. And I was like, Tom, like, there's only about four people in the world that have read my dissertation. My wife wouldn't even read my dissertation. Like, why are you reading it? And he went on to explain that as a method actor, when he's preparing for a role, he does a lot of research in order to understand that role. And so for military roles or other roles, my research was super helpful. And then he said, but I don't understand why you didn't talk about residue. And up until this point, Coleman, I had never heard this term before. And I was like, I'm sorry, Tom, I don't know this term and the way you're using it or anything. And he goes, and this is the way he explained it to me, and it's explained in the paper, but I remember it viscerally. He says, you know, I played Bane in Batman. So when I play a role like that, I become Bane. So for a period of my life, I think about the way that Bane thinks, and I try to embody that and his mannerisms and everything else. But let's say that a year after that, I've got to play the Prime Minister or, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or whatever. I have to get rid of the residue of Bane. Otherwise, I'm going to sound like a really screwed up, you know, like a very dangerous Mahatma Gandhi. That wouldn't be useful to anyone. It wouldn't be compelling as an actor. And there's processes that we go through to get rid of that residue of that lived experience. And Coleman, as he's talking, right, I'm standing at an event for wounded warriors. All around me are people that have been injured, some physically, some obviously, some not obviously, some internally, some psychologically. But they're all around me. And I know that some of them, based on what I said before, within a few years, we'll be thinking about if not committing suicide. And all of this is weighing on me. And I'm listening to Tom talk about residue. And I'm like, oh my God, I know what you're talking about. Like, I'm not an actor, but I know what you're talking about. And I look around at some of the operators that brought me there and were accompanying Tom. And I'm watching the same visceral reaction that I'm having happening on their faces. And I'm like, yes, as a person myself, Preston, as somebody who has been the primary EMT response to somebody who's dying, I know what it is to not be fast and smart enough, right? And so I know what it is to have residue, this thing that you carry forward. And so I left that meeting, and it wasn't a very long conversation. Tom and I have kept in touch since then. He's been incredibly helpful in guiding my thinking about all of this. And I remember leaving there as I get when I encounter something that has that kind of aha moment or that visceral reaction, a new concept or a new way of thinking, where suddenly things become possible that weren't possible before. Suddenly some things, ideas are revealed that were blind, that I was blind to previously. And I felt like this is one of those moments where I suddenly saw a thing I hadn't seen before, and it explained so much. And I remember leaving there, driving home for the 4 hours or whatever it was to get from Virginia back to Philly. And I remember just thinking more and more and more about it. And so about a month after that, I remember calling you and us talking about it. I remember talking to some other operators. And about a month later, when I was guest lecturing out at the Air Force Weapons School in Nevada, I went to see a mutual friend of ours named Jelani Hale. Jelani is a, former Navy SEAL. He's done a number of other things and is now a sort of an executive at the Wynn Casinos, kind of a big deal, huge brain, huge experience. And we always, when I'm out there working for the weapons school, we always make sure we have coffee or whatever just to check in. And I arrive and he's looking at me and he's like, "Preston, something seems a little like you're distracted. What's going on?" And I was like, "Well, it's going to sound weird, but let me explain to you what happened to me." And Jelani had a visceral reaction, like an emotional reaction that mirrored my own. He's like, "Not only do I know what you're talking about, but I happen to be good friends with Scott Glenn, the actor. Let me reach out to him and find out if this is a real thing or if this is just Tom being Tom." Not that I know what that is. And so Jelani not only reaches out to Scott Glenn, but then Scott Glenn emails me a 2-page paper on basically the truth behind what Tom's saying on, yeah, not only is it real, but if you're going to be a successful actor, you've got to figure out how to process residue. So I'm like, okay, this is a real thing. So I start writing up what we call as a green paper. A green paper in research is where you don't have any research to justify what you're talking about, but you've had this phenomenon, this lived experience that you know others brain also have. And so you write it up briefly and you send it out. And while I'm doing this, Sean Hulls, who at the time was the director of high performance for the Philadelphia Eagles, and I met him when he was working at Naval Special Warfare. He's now with the Cleveland Browns. Sean and I, he was coming to teach at one of our programs, and we had this discussion, and he said, "You know, Preston, one of the problems," because we had just talked about the DR4 model, which I mentioned just a little bit ago, and he said, "One of the problems that I have with the recovery movement," and it's a well-meaning, really good program, people are not trying to do any harm, but the problem is that when you take in a professional athlete or a special operations folks, somebody who has been a high performer all their life, and you say, "Okay, your career's over and you're broken, and now you have to get in recovery. You've received trauma, and now you have to recover from that trauma." Psychologically, it's debilitating for them, for many of them, because it suddenly gives them an identity, and we know this from labeling theory, that we take on the labels that are given to us. It gave them a label that wasn't true for them, that wasn't true for their soul. And they couldn't figure out how to reconcile the dissonance between feeling as though they were an elite performer and being told that they were a victim of trauma that needed to recover. And this dissonance would create this toilet bowl cycle of depression and shame and embarrassment and dissonance and not knowing what's going on. And Sean was saying how frustrated he was with this movement and how he wishes that we could, instead of moving from a trauma-based approach to these things, to move to a strength-based approach to these things. So right around this time, I was in contact with Tom, and Tom had seen my early draft before I shared it with anyone on residue. And he was like, "Mate, you're missing the point here." And I was like, "What?" He's like, "You're characterizing residue as this dark tar that coats your soul and then weighs you down and kills you." And I'm like, "Yeah."
He's like, "No.
Residue isn't just about when bad things happen. Residue is about all experiences. Your first kiss, your first time you fall in love, the first time you win an award. All of it is the residue, is the fuel that feeds you, that makes you who you are. What you're talking about is those experiences where you're not able to process it. You don't have the tools to make meaning of what just happened." And so the examples that we often use, Coleman, you and I, and with operators, is when your buddy gets killed next to you. There's no training in the military that says, "Oh, here's what happens when your buddy killed next to you." There's no training for that. So you're thrust into this experience of which you have no prior training or education for and no tools to make meaning of. And so that thing, that experience, that the residue is the substance that memories and experience leave behind, that instead of that becoming the fuel that makes you more you, makes you the wise elder, the sort of sage, it now turns into this sort of toxic poison, this septic stuff that, because it doesn't get processed, kind of rots inside of you. And it builds up, more and more of it builds up until you drown into it. But if you had the tools, that same substance could make you great. And it wasn't until Tom kind of reframed it for me that I was like, "Oh, it's not good or bad. Residue is not good or bad. It just is what it is. It is the stuff that we all live It's our lived experience made real, made into the tools that make us able to navigate the world around us. And so as I sat there thinking about this, I thought back to one of my earliest mentors and academic mentors and advisor, a guy named Dr. Mike Nuccola, who now is at Penn, but was at Harvard. And he was my advisor for my master's at Harvard. And he introduced me to this program called the Search Institute. Because if you remember, I got my start working with kids in trouble. And kids in trouble at the time in the 80s, everyone was talking about kids at risk. Well, they weren't talking about kids at risk for winning the lottery or at risk for suddenly getting into an Ivy League school. No, they were talking about the risk of death, disaster, recidivism, all that. So risk was a wholly bad concept in their mind. And we're going to talk about risk in another episode. But in their particular mind, risk was bad. Search Institute said, well, hold. What if we flip the whole thing? What are the assets that any kid needs to be great? Let's forget about the sort of risk of variables that might lead you to disaster. What about the other side of it? What are the strengths that you need to actually be successful? And no one had been asking this question. So Mike got me involved in this sort of project about validating their research, and I became deep into it. And so when this residue paper came up, it was the same concept. Everyone was telling me about, oh, this is PTSD. How do we help you, you know, recover from trauma and all that? I was like, whoa, how about we start from a very different perspective? How about we say these men and women are amazing. They lack the tools to process extreme experiences. How about we figure out what tools effectively have been used and then give them those tools to see if we can increase the likelihood they're going to turn those experiences into the fuel that make them even greater. And that simple, subtle thing, just to bring us full circle, in this process where we've had hundreds of operators, of actors, of psychologists, of neuroscientists contribute over the last 18 months, one of the things that happens, and it always chokes me up when I talk about it, is we've now had four people tell me that being part of this project was the determinant factor for them not committing suicide. And all of them say it because it was the first time anyone said, are you in pain? Yep, you are. Is it suck? Yep, it does. But it's not, you're not cursed. It's not forever. This is not the new you. You're still awesome, but you've been injured and now you have to recover from that injury. And here's some strength-based ways to do that. So you're not broken. And all we say to people is, you know, from a medical point of view, I can splint my own sprained wrist, but I can't splint my own broken arm, not with effectiveness. I need help with that. Same thing. If I have an argument with you, Coleman, I can sort out my feelings about that argument. But if you and I are walking by and we see a kid run over by a car, we're probably want to talk into somebody because that's beyond a sprained wrist. That's like traumatic. So the question though is, and this is the most important point because my language has been a little conflated right then, is let's say the bad thing does happen. What are the strengths, the assets that we can give to Coleman and Mott and myself and to all of you? What can we do beforehand so that when the bad thing happens, you can make a meaning of it and you can turn that event, a great thing or terrible thing, into the thing that makes you a better version of you?
Thanks for that. There's a couple things we want to weave in and out of here. We know our community really well, meaning the MCTI community, and yeah. I'll put the whole community plus a lot of other people outside of our community who have spent a lot of time at the, so let's just call it the tip of the spear of their world, whatever your world is. I think one of the things that became clear to me early on in the process of the whole community putting this paper together, this project together, and unpacking this idea of residue. And one thing I think that complicates it for, and I'll just speak for the veterans, is this idea of like, because there are epic books about people at war, and war is such a thing, right? There's, of course, Sebastian Junger's books. There's All Quiet on the Western Front. There's Cara Morlante's books, What It Is Like to Go to War, right? And a quote-unquote normal person who's never been in like a very serious, sustained, long-duration, life-threatening situation often and fairly and nicely and maybe appropriately, maybe not, but I know with my own experience and many other teammates that come back or get out of the military or come back from deployment, and you're almost like you're labeled with this veteran exceptionalism type of thing where nobody everybody almost wants to give you like a pass on like, oh my God, your experience is so amazing, right? And then on page 20, one of our collaborators, I won't bring up his name, says, quote, I think most operators believe they should take on the persona of the wounded, salty, slightly mentally damaged, road-weary nomad. Not that they want sympathy, but that they also want their character to reflect the cost and the miles on them, even if they appear in physical tip-top shape. And there's this, because you mentioned labeling theory, I think this is to Tom's point about residues not good or bad. We all, as humans, just have these experiences. For some of the mission critical team people, a guy who ran into a fire in New York City, a pilot who safely landed a plane that had no engines firing, right? People like that will sometimes get a label, and then it's almost like the label adds lighter fluid to the residue in either direction. And speaking purely from my own experience, from my lived experience, is the process of having so many collaborators and finding out what was really behind this concept that Tom Hardy shared with you was helpful to me to know that it didn't have anything to do with operator, athlete, astronaut, pilot, veteran exceptionalism. It just has something to do with life. And that removed the conversation out of you are standing on an island. And I know you can take us into one of our other colleagues, the idea of suffering as a privilege. But it took us off that island of, oh my gosh, you're the only one, or your category of people are the only people who know what those life experiences are like. And I don't think that's true. I don't think it has to be a life-threatening situation.
I think you're totally right. So the way I would explain this, and I've been trying to figure out a way to explain this to folks that haven't lived in extreme environments. And one of the ways I've been doing this is, have you ever walked out of your house one day and gone on vacation or met somebody who's going to change your life? And in that process, in that experience, you are different and you know you're different. Like whatever it was, like the vacation, or you saw a movie, or you read a book, or you had this conversation, or you, whatever it was. And you're like, wow, I now think about the world differently. And then you walk back home at the end of the day, they think you're the same person you were when you walked out the door that morning, but you know you're not. And then you're like, oh my God, I went to the Galapagos and I saw this, and they're just staring at you because they don't know, they haven't been to the Galapagos, they don't know what you're talking about. And you're trying to re-explain or describe this life-changing transformational event, and they're just staring at you, and then you get dismissed because they can't make meaning of it. And I think what happens is, that one, we all have a duty to try to articulate our own changes, which is requires some self-reflection, right? But we also have a duty not to get trapped by our personal mythology. And one of the things that I see, and I sadly see this with folks who have been in like known publicized events, Captain Sully with the landing of the plane or others, not picking on him, obviously, but that they get pigeonholed into this one event in their life. And they're like, everyone, oh, you're the guy who did the thing. And you're like, A, that was 10 years ago. And B, I did a bunch of other things as well. And so we have a responsibility to be able to articulate our own truths in a way other people can understand them. And then we all have a responsibility to not pigeonhole people into or define them by one experience. That's the one thing I would say. I can certainly talk about suffering as privilege if you'd like.
For the five people who, of all the listeners who will actually read the paper, you and I are two of them, so maybe three other people who are actually
three other people.
But at least we'll follow the arc of the narrative here. So just talk for a second, Preston, because this comes up a lot in our interactions at our summits and courses and these other things, and I think it's such a simple concept. But it's funny how even the most experienced folks, when they're sitting in the room with all of us, and you share the idea of, we know how to get in the zone or flip the switch, but do we know how to turn the game face off? Just talk about that for a second before we move on.
It was something that I see in our work, Coleman, with professional sports teams or with elite teams. You hear it all the time, like, all right, folks, put your game face on. It's time to go. And then I'm the guy that's not going out in the field with them, but I'm the one watching them go out and then watching them come back. And I know for a fact, I've never heard anyone say, okay, now time to take the game face off and here's how you do it. I've never in my life heard that. And yet everybody comes back and they're like, wow, that was a lot. And I don't know how to explain it. And you were next to me and I don't know how to explain it. And I go, we're missing a huge opportunity here to be able to develop some strengths to help those in the world, because to take their game faces off. And there's all these myths, right, about, well, we didn't have to do it in World War II. Yeah, except that most people don't know that the suicide rate for veterans in World War II was horrific. Most people don't know that. The Greatest Generation paid a price that people don't talk about. And that's not me in any way minimizing their courage and their extraordinary nature. But it is, we need to be more honest about the fact that this has always been the case. We need to do better.
Yeah, and so one of the things I know we have plans to continually look into, it's one of the reasons we interviewed Dr. Andrew Huberman, at least as far as we're concerned, not fully defined and fully answered question, whether good or bad, and I'll try to explain what I mean here, is, and think about this very, very like tactically, where does an experience go? Physically, where does it go, right? Yeah. There's the hippocampus does, obviously, it controls memory. So an experience goes into our memory, but the literature shows us that memories over time become horrendously inaccurate. So did your experience become inaccurate, quote unquote? We know from talking to Michael Platt and Zab and Joe at the Wharton Neuroscience Institute and Dr. Andrew Huberman at Stanford that experiences leave a chemical and hormonal signature, right? They get imprinted somewhere in the body, right? And this is a huge rabbit hole. But the reason I bring this up is because of the taking the game face off. What we haven't thought about for quite some time is if you talk to most like operators who have a heavy physical requirement on their job, they can tell you a lot about how to physically train up and then recover. So they can physically train up and then recover. And we don't have the ability yet to say a lot about turning the dial up and then turning it back down. And how do we know we come back down to baseline? The truth is like, we're not there yet. And this 18-month effort of building the residue paper and having this conversation and getting feedback from the community and talking to other people in the future is an attempt to understand going from baseline to tip of the spear performance and then turning the dial back down, because that's just not something that gets ingrained in us when we're, I'm making up the age, but when you go through basic training, you're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. The only thing you care about is turning the dial up. And that's what you learned.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's an incredibly important point, Coleman, because, you know, as you often talk about going harder, faster, right, with more intensity, that's what gets taught. But no one ever says, oh, yeah, and by the way, later you're going to have to dial that back down, to your point. I think one of the other interesting things, just to go back to what you just said a moment ago, is most of our listeners will be familiar with the mind-brain problem. But just for those of us who aren't, let me explain. If I take a scalpel and I find somebody and I have permission, I can open up their skull and find their brain. So I can find Preston's brain. I can't find Preston. No matter how hard I dig in the brain, I can't find the spot that Preston, the concept, the personality, the lived experience, where I can hold it up and be like, here's the kidney, here's the heart, here's the brain, here's Preston. That we don't have that. We don't have that science, and we're not even close to it. And so, you know, a lot of people who make these definitive statements in the world like,
oh yeah, we've locked that in,
always remind yourself like, really? Because there's a lot we don't know.
I want to move to suffering as a privilege, because ND, because we don't name people in this paper who are still, but for the three people other than me and you who will read the paper, they'll see him as ND. He gave us some great input on suffering as privilege. And I want to share with the audience, like, how important this one concept that I learned after I was out of the military, and it'll lead us into suffering as a privilege. And we've kind of alluded to it here, is in 1908, French anthropologist, philosopher Arnold van Gennep wrote the book Rites of Passage, where when I first read the book, it was the first time I had seen where the idea of the sacred and the profane was explained. And in terms of the contrast of those two words, what Van Gennep meant by the sacred and the profane was a person has a certain type of experience. You had just alluded to this idea. You didn't say sacred and profane, but you had alluded to this idea a minute ago, which is essentially where we're going to go with why this matters to residue. But it's the idea that a person or a group of people pass through this fairly life-shaping event or multiple events. And when you come back to quote unquote, you know, normalcy, you've now become sacred relative to the group that didn't go through the thing. And that carries a valence of some sort that it's very hard to explain the, again, not that the suffering is good or bad, but that the experience you went through that made you sacred in the eyes of the non-sacred group, because you passed through this threshold, it leaves you with a residue that's difficult to explain or process or integrate or whatever. And it makes suffering a privilege in a way. And I just wanted you to share what ND had shared in the paper about that.
Yeah. So ND is a trauma medical doctor. He's seen a lot of things. And as Coleman and I talk about Joseph Campbell's work and the hero's journey or a monomyth, where some of this stuff around liminality and the work that we talk about from an anthropological point of view comes from, one of the comments that I'll often tell people is that if you follow, you know, Star Wars or Wizard of Oz, right, is that Luke Skywalker didn't go fight the Empire because he got a lightsaber, and Dorothy didn't go to the wizard because she got ruby slippers. It's not the stuff, and it's hard that when they get home, they go back to Tatooine or they go back to Kansas to try to explain what just happened. But to Coleman's point, there is a sacredness involved. There is a sacrifice and suffering involved. And when ND first explained it to me, he pointed out that suffering as privilege exists in almost all major religions. And it's this idea that if you really want to be transformed in your life, a certain amount of suffering is going to be required. But it's a privilege because that suffering allows you to see things other people cannot see. And it means it goes from the ordinary world to the extraordinary world, but you can't stay there. You have to come home. And it's the coming home that can be tricky.
I think there is something to be said about Csikszentmihalyi's research and his book, which many people will recognize the title Flow, which I have here, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, Steps Toward Enhancing the Quality of Life is actually the subtitle. And it's funny how things like deliberate practice, deep work, flow, etc., at least in the worlds in which we move around, and even in the general podcast sphere, you hear people talk a lot more about these types of psychological, like, performance things. The funny thing is, like, Csikszentmihalyi's book Flow was published in 1990.
Yeah.
And the concepts are really only being talked about now with a deliberate intent to look into these type of, you know, call them psychological things around life experience in general. And I don't want to drag us too far down the flow rabbit hole, but there's probably something to be said about that here.
Yeah. And what I would like to talk about, Coleman, on that particular is not the individual human performance aspects of flow, but in the sort of shared flow. So yeah. That feeling that you and I have had, that others on this teamcast will have had, which is, if you think back to the moment where the joy of being on, of joining a tribe of people who you just click with, that when you move together, it is unanimous, and it is something else. It is a transformational experience. And then that moment where you have to leave the team, because we all do, and the days that follow, there is such mourning and loss. It's like something's been amputated. And this is not an insignificant problem, because when you are used to being something extraordinary, Olympic athletes talk about this, professional sports players talk about this, that at the height of their performance, when they're with a group of people that are performing at that same level, and then they no longer have access to that physical experience, there's a certain amount of mourning and withdrawal that has to happen.
Yeah, which is a natural jump here into L.A., Dr. Eli Alvarez out at Stanford University School of Medicine, who's a close colleague of ours. L.A.'s comment here in the paper in this area of the conversation was, you know, the residents and doctors, he believes that a sudden loss of belonging can often contribute to burnout when there was no really indication that there was like a physiological burnout. That really resonated with me because a couple, as you know, Preston, like 4 or 5 years after I had gotten out of the Navy and I was moving around in the spaces I was moving around, I had never read Csikszentmihalyi's full research and book on flow. And he goes into a topic here that I want to share that's in the paper. on page 86, he says there's two terms that describe a state of social pathology that make conditions of flow very, very difficult for a person. One is called anomie, A-N-O-M-I-E, and the other is alienation. And I'll go on to, I'll just share his definitions with you. Anomie is literally, quote unquote, a lack of rules. It's a name a French sociologist Emile Durkheim gave to a condition in society in which the norms of behavior had become muddled. This can often lead to alienation, which is in many ways the opposite. It's a condition in which people are constrained by the social system to act in ways that go against their goals. Now, to be clear, my norms of behavior just were what they were, and I didn't think external society was imposing any constraints on me. The fact was I had such a conditioned behavior in one environment that I felt like I was experiencing anomie and alienation at like some dangerous level of the highest RPMs I could possibly experience it. And I know this is what Tom Hardy and the actors have shared with us, is like, remember, you have submitted yourself to certain norms in method acting and certain constraints of that human dynamic. And then when you pull out of that to do that in a different dynamic, there's a massive amount of like psychic disturbance that goes along with it. Again, not necessarily negative, but just knowing something about Van Gennep's research, Csikszentmihalyi's research, Joseph Campbell's book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, that there are some models that can point to the most likely situations in your life where residue is going to have a valence. That was important. That was a massive discovery for me.
So think about this. It's so important what you're talking about, because especially right now. So think about a surgical doctor, right? A doctor of surgery at a hospital right now. 2 months ago, 3 months ago, they were top of their game, confident. They had high competence. They had regular rules, both in their personal life and in their medical life. The amount of uncertainty they faced in their personal life was quite low. And in their professional life, it was in a reasonable threshold that have always been there in the discovery of medicine. But for the most part, they knew what their expertise was and how to deliver on it. Fast forward 3 months later, all the rules have changed, both in medicine, their lived experience has changed and the number of uncertainties have gone up, and their personal life has gone up. And so they're managing like anomie and alienation every day. Because all the old rules, not all of them, but many of them have become muddled and confusing. And things they used to lean on the bad days are now unstable. And so everything's unstable. And because they're doctors, people are leaning on them for support and clarification. And they who normally have sort of know, don't know.
And so there's layers of this happening right now
that's destabilizing so many people.
Yeah. And it's worth noting Dr. Art Finch's comments here in the paper on page 10, where he talks about duration of a transition, because whether we all like it or not, the idea of liminality, you know, being pulled between two quote unquote worlds in a way, or that place of, you know, a new, for lack of a better term, becoming something new, but not quite there yet. And we're stuck in this liminality for a little bit here, because whether it's a person's internal family dynamic, meaning, you know, somebody was 3 kids under the age of 6 climbing on them at home right now, or it's a doctor on the front lines, or it's somebody whose business is massively disrupted, or it's an athlete who their season is canceled, or it's kids who their high school season, you know, everybody is stuck in this in-between state. And it's not the most comforting thing to know that, but I want to share it here anyway, that I remember when Harry Moffat, our colleague in Australia, asked me about my own transition. I think I was like 6 or 7 years into it, meaning from the military to the regular world. I thought I was still in it, and I'm at year 9 and I'm still in it now. And, you know,
and Harry thought he could take care of it that weekend.
Yeah, it was like, I'll be good by Monday, right? I'm like, well, that would be awesome, Harry. And then you can just tell me how to do it, because I'm not fully done with it yet. But, you know, Dr. Finch was just saying, you know, many, many positions of acute liminality, the transition is 4 to 6 weeks. I think it's way longer, but it's not 24 hours.
Yeah. And I think we'll get to the part where we talk about some recommendations for what you can do in your life. But one of the things you're going to hear us say over and over again is intentionality. So a lot of things you're reacting to right now. So any parts of your life where you can insert choices will help you. There are better choices and worse choices, but like choices to exercise is good. A regimen of exercise is good. It's good not just for the obvious reasons, but some other psychological reasons about having some things in your life that you get both control and are regimented, meaning that they happen every day or every other day.
So let's go to a few, because as usual, you and I managed to burn up on the order of like 40 minutes here. Section 4, building skills and environment to process residue. This is straight off the paper, but before I go into some of the sections of just the what to do's on Monday, Preston, why don't you just talk about the ones that in the year and a half of research of putting this together, which to-do's on Monday do you think are most important?
So it's a great question, Coleman. And after several months of doing this, this is my answer. If you read the paper, you're going to notice that what we don't do is tell you what to do. What we do is ask you a series of questions. And the reason we do that is because everyone's different. There's no silver bullet. Coleman and I are never going to be like the guys that are like, drink some water and take these two pills and you'll get sorted. You're never going to hear us say that. What we can, though, do is ask you some questions that can help frame your current lived experience and ask you some hard questions. And so for me, and I really am speaking now as Preston, not like an expert on this, but as a human living through COVID, there are certain variables that I know that I lean on all the time. And so things like, what am I doing to actively maintain the relationships in my family? And so what am I actively doing to making sure that the people who know me best and can be the first ones to notice if I go sideways, what am I doing to make sure that they're in a good place and we're in a good place? Exercise is something that, because I know Coleman, I'm working on it, getting better at, but it's something I've always struggled with. But I will tell you that in this COVID, by being intentional about it, it's helped everywhere else. Naming things. There are, you know, as we get news of sorrowful things, I name them now. I'm like, this just happened and it's tough. But here's the irony. I'm also learning how to compliment people. I'm learning how to celebrate people, right?
Congratulations.
Thank you. But it's also what's really interesting, right, Coleman, is that, you know, if somebody pays me a compliment, it's still in me to want to defer it, deny it, just, you know, dispel it, be like, no, it was everybody. But what I'm learning to do is just shut up and say thank you, to honor both the person who's giving to me and to make me own it a little bit, to process that residue, right? Because one of the things that mission critical teams are really good at is we can take negative feedback all day long and take notes. But if I sit one of you down that are listening and I say, I'm going to spend 5 minutes telling you why you're awesome, your blood pressure will go up. You'll be like, oh, no, deeply uncomfortable. No, thank you. And we got to fix that. Because while it's important to know what wrong looks like, it's more important to know what right looks like. And we can't do that if we're not talking about it. And if you are role modeling that behavior, that means that you're role modeling it for the people who are watching. And I guess, Coleman, without getting, and we can touch on any of these, but here's the one message that I will keep saying to people all the time when they talk to me about residue. There's a bunch of people that are listening to us or reading this paper that are saying, well, I'm pretty good. I'm like, okay, I'm doing some of this stuff, but I'm managing it. But I don't really need to change that much. I'll just muddle my way through. And here's what I want to tell you. People don't listen, they watch. There's a bunch of people that are looking up to you, that are taking your behavior as cues to their own behavior, that are watching and learning, whether they be children or subordinates or whatever, they're watching you. And you got to ask yourself this question. Is what I'm doing right now sustainable and healthy? Am I cursing the people that are looking up to me, or am I enabling and supporting them and empowering them? Anything other than empowerment is harm, not just to you, but to them. So what I'm telling you is don't change, don't do these things because you need to be better. Doesn't matter. What matters is you're doing these things because the people who are watching you might also do them. That's what matters.
Yeah, people, these are reflections I wish I had known and had language for way, way earlier in my life. I think we probably all know, at least in our worlds of, you know, specifically the mission critical teams community, but everybody, is people look for where right looks like. And what we what we model is, even if it's not necessarily good, we're basically saying to our team, this is what right looks like, because I have a position of either title authority or achievement authority or something. And if it's allowed to be done, then it'll continue. And I know LA and the medical teammates we have, they bring this up all the time, because everybody knows what, you know, everybody who's at least close to some doctors, nurses, et cetera, we know what life is like as a intern, a resident, and it's a crazy lifestyle. I mean, they bring this up a lot, these ideas of, it's not just about burnout and stuff. The point is that, like, cultures inside of different teams perpetuate both good and bad, right? And we just need to be aware of that as it pertains to this idea of residue. And I think on page 18, one of the questions we ask in this litany of things about how to build skills around both the good and the bad, super intense experiences, is how are you becoming more self-aware? And I want to just hear more of your thoughts on this, Preston, but I just want to call out for the group one of the things that really, really taught me something about, you know, again, this idea of residue was about how open-minded to theory, concepts, applications that I thought I was when I was operating at the tip of the spear, still in the military. And when I got out and I got exposed to new ideas, new research, real actual literature on the physiologies and psychology of, let's just call it, long duration efforts that did create different type of residue, I realized how closed-minded I was. And one of the things that somebody else noted in the paper here was from the book In an Unspoken Voice by Dr. Peter Levine, who's a colleague of Bessel van der Kolk's, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score. There's a note here that in Peter Levine's research, it says the people who are most resilient and find the most peace in their lives have learned to tolerate extreme sensations while gaining the capacity for reflective self-awareness. I will say, just as an N of one, I have a number of times in my life where I had the ability to tolerate extreme sensations, but I did not have the capacity for reflective self-awareness. And for those who aren't seeing the video, Preston's laughing right now, so I'm gonna let him make a comment about that.
I would say that one of the big things in our current environment, our sort of culture of certainty, where people think they know the truth, and this is, you know, a political thing, a religious thing, it's a lot of things. I'm always shocked by this. And what I would challenge you to do, all of you, is that if you're sitting on the cheap seats or in a bar stool saying, man, if people would just listen to me, I have the answers, right? You should question that, like, deeply. And I mean deeply. Take something that you really believe in, like, to your soul and core. Find somebody or find some literature that compellingly argues against it. And just try to understand that perspective. Because if you can, I'm not asking you to agree with it. I'm not asking you to change your mind at all. What I'm asking you to do is authentically engage with the opposing idea. Because what it will do is it'll force you to reconsider some of your ways of thinking. Always remember that when totalitarian regimes, whether it be religious or political, the first thing they want to do is tap down dissent and thinking, right? They want to tap down schools and everything else because they don't want you questioning orthodoxy. What I want you to do is question your own orthodoxy, your personal orthodoxy. I want you to take these truths that you think are absolutely solid and question them.
This isn't a public service announcement for journaling, but later in one of the questions, what are you actively doing to reflect on your lived experience? It's kind of in the same vein, because I know more than a couple dozens of guys who, when they had the time, when they went to spend a month at the NICO, at the National Center, National Intrepid Center of Excellence there in Bethesda, or at another one somewhere else in the country. And I was never a diarist. I was never a journaler, really. But when a lot of guys that I know, when they've had a chance to sit down and take a lived experience or an orthodoxy and write that at the top of the page, and then try to logically follow when you're at handwriting pace, not at thinking pace, at handwriting pace, convince yourself of what you think is actually true in writing, everybody, like, tighten your boots up, because it's going to be tough.
There's an exercise that we recommend that everyone can look up, and it was started by NPR, and it's called This I Believe. And all it asks you to do on half of one piece of paper is write down something you believe in that you would let someone else read. And you're like, yeah, no sweat. I'll knock that out today. You will find it will be hard.
Very difficult. And if it's not of this, I believe, forget what you believe. Take what actually happened. You know, make it easier. Write lived experience down and follow the logic. It's a surprisingly challenging thing to do.
There's three other ones, Coleman, that I want to talk about, but two are combined. So I'm going to hit those now. Our friend, Reverend Sue Phillips, who we met, you know, a few months ago. And one of the things listening to her talk, which I thought was really compelling because all she was sort of talking about was the human lived experience. And she says one of the problems with the corporate environment is that we've forgotten that people have a soul, right? That they need certain things. And what she would say is that people need belonging, becoming, belonging, becoming, and beyond, which is this idea of being known, being fully loved, growing our capacity to become what we think we can be, right? And then experiencing ourselves as something more, which leads us to this question of what are you in service to? So the thing I want to touch base here is that if you're on a team, you are both in belonging and connectedness, and you are in service to something greater than yourself. When you leave that team, you lose both of those things. So this brings us to our third thing, which is literally called the third thing. And it's not meant that way, but it turned out nicely that way. The third thing, it goes back to Harry Moffat. Harry Moffat, who is in a rock band, who we have to plug the name of the, is it the, we got to look up his rock band, Coleman, because if we don't, Harry will be mad at us. Okay. So Harry Moffat, when he would talk about leaving service and special operations after many years, we asked what was the thing that helped him the most. And he says, well, the truth is that being part of a rock band and being part of a cricket team was really helpful because I had a third thing. Do you have the name of the band?
The Externals.
The Externals. So we got to plug the Externals whenever we get a chance, because otherwise Harry will freak out. So Harry's a songwriter and a lead singer on the Externals, in addition to being a operator. And what he said was, hey, look, I can leave rooms where the fate of the world is resting on my shoulders, go home, go to the garage, and all the boys care about is whether or not I learn the lyrics to the song. And that third thing was so key, because when I left being an operator, they never knew me that way. I had a whole identity and everything else. I had belonging, connectedness, and I was in service to something else, the band. And what we find is that this having a third thing, right, is really, really, really important if you live in an immersive job. But here's the thing. This is the part that people miss. The first couple of years I was a wilderness guide, or I'm guessing, Coleman, when you were a SEAL, if somebody had said to us in those early days, first year or two, hey, you need a third thing, we'd both be like, go away. Like, we were so deep into just loving our job and our community and being, it was all new, and we just wanted to be good at our jobs. That's what everything was we were focused on. And that's right. Just stay there, be that guy or be that woman. But know that within 2-3 years, you need to start developing those outside sort of hobbies, groups, church groups, whatever it is that you want, but something.
Yeah, and that wasn't, I'll put myself on the chopping block here. That wasn't even in the early days for me. The first time I ever walked into the NICO, I got out in 2011, walked into the NICO to see Dr. Bob Kaufman in the fall of 2015. And either nobody laugh or everybody laugh, either one works for me. He asked me what my hobby was, and I told him PT. For those who don't know, PT is physical training. And he said, he chuckled, because he has seen a lot of us, right? And he said, no, seriously. And I said, no, seriously. That's my hobby. And that's just not good. That's my scientific analysis of how good or bad that is. That wasn't healthy, right? And so yeah. Congratulations to Harry and the Externals. The last note I want to just get your thoughts on, Preston, here, that's, again, in the series of questions that we ask around residue. Everybody brace for, for Coleman using this term, but it actually means a lot to me now for a reason I'll explain here. Practicing, how are we actively practicing self-compassion? And I think one of my superpowers is if I beat myself up hard enough, I could perform better, because I was basically competing against myself, right? That was very effective strategy. Here was another sort of another nod to Harry here, like a cricket bat in the face a couple of years ago when I was reading positive psychology research. Dr. Marty Seligman, of course, who's at UPenn, his book, read both of his, two of his books back to back, Learned Optimism and then Flourish. And inside of, I can't remember if it's inside of Learned Optimism or in the middle of Flourish, he has his series of tests in there, which are like the core optimism score. You get a core pessimism score, and then you get a self-esteem score, and then you get a hope score. And my hope score, I suppose, like my ability to sit in those extreme circumstances, and other guys, and I'll talk about other people here in a second, because they scored similarly. My hope score was in the top, whatever, 5%. And my self-esteem score was in the bottom 5%. And I haven't read all of Amy Chua's research on this, but another colleague of ours said that I should. But I was so curious. I was like, is my self-esteem really that low? And I have this email list that's much bigger now, but at the time it was like 70 people. And I sent out the links to those tests, which of course Positive Psychology Center has online. And I got, I know this isn't a valid sample size, but 46 people of our type of colleagues took the survey, and every single one of them scored below 15% in self-esteem and like in the upper 3% of the hope score. And that, again, Coleman's unscientific like research, that means something.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, as you were talking, one of the,
every once in a while, I don't know,
5 years or so, or in the aftermath of, say, a fatality or something where the experience overwhelms my ability to cope with it, I'd go and talk to somebody. So about, oh God, now 20 years ago, 15 years ago, after a young girl had been killed and I'd been part of the team, I was starting to lose it a little bit. So I went to talk to this Vietnam veteran counselor. This guy had seen every, he had counseled Vietnam vets, you know, off of alcoholism and suicide. So me, I was a nice day. I was a Thursday for him. So I go in and I'm telling him this experience. I'm an absolute mess. I'm just a mess. And he goes, what's the worst part about this for you? And I was like, and I look up, right, wiping my nose and drying my eyes. And I'm like, here's the thing, doc. I'm trained in all of this. I'm trained in critical incident stress debriefing. I'm trained in trauma. I'm trained in all of this. I know better. I should know how to fix this.
And he looks up and he just looks right by and goes, how's that working out for you?
I was like, not well. And he was like, exactly. Welcome to the human race. Just because you know a thing doesn't make you exempt from being human.
Yeah, it is almost identical sentence to Dr. Kaufman and another colleague who did all my colleague, friend, buddy, whatever, who did all my screening at when I went into Green Team, stayed in touch with them forever. And I went to see him around the same time frame that I went to see Dr. Kaufman at the NICO. And I said, guys, look, go harder for longer with more intensity, like works every time. And he looked at me, he was like, how's it working right now? Well, it worked every time until now. He's like, this is the point, Coleman. Like, you cannot turn the dial to the right without turning it back to the left. And the question is, how can we do that better? The question to close us out here, the question to the whole community is, what are your teams learning? Are you guys doing better? You know where to find Preston and I. Please let us know where things are advancing, where your teams are doing a good job, where we can all do a better job, what other things we can look into. Because I'll say from my experience, the last 18 months of getting the consolidated perspectives on this residue paper, I don't know. Well, I do know it's helped me a lot. Just knowing a little bit more about a thing to this extent has really helped me, you know, just live life in a little bit more equanimity, so to speak. And that would have been really useful to me 15 years ago.
The big thing that people ask me, like, what do I really want to say about this residue paper? And it's this. If you're listening to this program, this is what I want to communicate to you. You are not broken. You're not a victim. You're not a survivor. You're a person who chose a life, and you chose a hard life. You left the pack to be in service to something great, and you had some extreme experiences, extreme good ones. You met amazing, extraordinary people, and probably some extreme bad ones. And you can splint a sprained wrist, but you can't splint a broken arm. You're going to need help. And you need to know not only what wrong looks like, but what right looks like. And we are social animals, so we need to do that collectively, and we need a language in which to talk about it. residue isn't a silver bullet. It's not going to save your life. It's not going to fix you. But it will help you with the process of learning a different way to work out, a more effective way to work out your soul and your heart and your mind and your brain and your relationships. And it's the beginning of a conversation, not the end of it. This paper is meant as a starting place, not an ending place. But we're going to need everybody involved. We need everyone contributing in order for all of us to help all of us. So one of the things we'd be remiss in not mentioning is that the actor Dennis Leary contributed to this paper. And the reason that matters is because Dennis, as you know, played Rescue Me for a number of years. And so he got to know and live FDNY guys in the aftermath of 9/11. And so in interviewing and his feedback on this paper, Dennis was talking about not only the experience of being an actor who is taking on a role and then managing the residue of that role, but also as a person who's playing somebody who is managing residue. And so the way that he talks about his experience and knowing FDNY guys the way he knows them, a lot of what he wrote about is just really compelling and important. And so I also just want to make sure that I recognize his contributions and the effect that he, Scott Glenn, and of course Tom Hardy had on the article and how we couldn't have done it without them. And yeah.
That's a great summary, Preston. Thanks. We'll close out there.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missioncti.com. That's J-A-N-E-S-E @missioncti.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Row Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.